It is Monday, November the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, could the Islamic State be emboldened by Paris attacks?
ISIS represents a direct threat for European security, and that Europe is now a new front of the Syrian war.
Also ahead, the plight of African migrants.
Migrants are coming because there's an arc of war from Africa all the way to Asia. It's bringing insecurity, causing poverty.
The race to choose a new U.S. president also ahead. Stay with us. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. French police have released a photo of the suspect who is still at large from the Friday night attacks on Paris that killed at least 132. Suspect is identified as Salah Abdeslam, a 26-year-old man born in Brussels, Belgium. He is one of three brothers linked to the string of near simultaneous attacks. Another brother, Ibrahim Salah, blew himself up at the Bataclan Music Hall during an attack that killed more than 80 people. Belgium authorities are detaining the third brother. Police in both France and Belgium have made several arrests and are also questioning family members and other people linked to the other suspected assailants. In its claim of responsibility, the Islamic State lashed out at the countries trying to suppress its attempts to establish a caliphate in Syria and Iraq, and said that France remains at the top of the list of preferred targets. The Associated Press is reporting that the Islamic State is determined to establish itself as the dominant jihadist movement capable of operating far beyond its limits of that self-declared caliphate. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Hudson Institute Europe research scholar Benjamin Haddad for his reaction.
I think that's true. It shows that ISIS represents a direct threat for European security, and that Europe is now a new front of the Syrian war. We've seen this already with the flow of refugees that are fleeing the conflict in Syria. And now, what happened in Paris 2 days ago is a new consequence of the situation in the Middle East. And we still need to have more information about the origins and the training, it appears that one of the terrorists who have been identified by the French police as a French citizen has trained in Syria in the winter of 2013-2014, and that this operation might have been planned from Syrian territory with the leadership of ISIS to expand the front in Europe.
With the migrant crisis now in full flower in Europe, what is it going to do for those who are trying to welcome these refugees and migrants?
There is a risk of political backlash against the refugees, which I think would be very troubling because it would represent, I think, a real confusion with what is going on. A lot of these people are fleeing repression. They're fleeing exactly what's been happening in Paris these last few days: violence, terrorism, radicalism. There's been a passport, a Syrian passport that apparently belonged to a refugee that's been found next to the body of one of the suicide bombers. It's still very unclear at this point if this is a real passport or not. And there is a risk of rising populism and xenophobia in Europe after these attacks. And I think this is something that European leadership should be very vigilant about.
At the G20 summit in Turkey, world leaders vowed on Sunday a vigorous response to the terrorist attacks in Paris. Of course, as you know, French jets went after IS headquarters in Raqqa in Syria. Will there be a newfound unity in fighting Islamic State?
I mean, it's true that the French authorities privately say that they consider that the United States has taken the back seat on everything that's been going on in Syria. The French have had a very strong position on the ouster of Assad as the only possible solution to the Syrian crisis from the start. It has started strikes in Syria to prevent potential terrorist attacks against the French territory already this summer. But I think now there's going to be a willingness from European countries and hopefully from the United States to ramp up the fight against ISIS in Syrian territory. The risk, if the U.S. doesn't take the lead on this, is that European leaders will be more and more pressured to side with Russia, which appears to offer the only alternative, only solution, which would be a catastrophe both for the transatlantic relation, but also for the situation in Syria, where saving Assad cannot possibly be a political solution to what's happening. I mean, that's the only offer and alternative that the Russians offer.
Well, Ben, of course, France has imposed a state of emergency, apparently the first in many decades. Has France turned a page, a chapter, if you will, in the fight against terrorism with this attack in Paris?
It certainly is a new phase of the war on terrorism in France. Now, this isn't new for the last few years, especially with the question of French citizens going to fight alongside jihadists in Syria. The French have ramped up intelligence services, and more money, means, and recruitment have been focused on intelligence and security services in France. Obviously, we had the Charlie Hebdo attacks just 10 months ago. So this has been a concern of French authorities recently. But I think now, clearly, this has become the defining issue of the Hollande presidency. And there are new debates over how to fight radicalism in mosques with propositions to maybe expel foreign radical imams who are preaching hatred. There's debate over what to do with people who are suspected of radicalism. There's also the central question of improving intelligence cooperation in Europe, because, as you know, apparently a lot of these attacks were also prepared in Belgium just by France. But definitely the fight against terror has become a central issue now in French political debates.
Benjamin Haddad is a research scholar specializing in Europe and more specifically France at the Hudson Institute. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. You can keep up to date on the Paris attacks, the investigation, and international response by going to our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Behe.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Kenyan athletics under a cloud following allegations of bribes and embezzlement involving both athletes and athletic officials. The charge comes as the Kenyan government teams up with the private sector to establish an anti-corruption group amid concerns over endemic graft in public institutions. Following the decision by the World Anti-Doping Agency to ban Russia from international track and field competition, the agency has turned its sights on Kenya, and the results could be a four-year ban, including the 2016 Rio Olympics. Reuters reports more than 30 Kenyan athletes have failed drug tests in recent years, including Rita Jeptu. She won the Boston and Chicago marathons. International Association of Athletic Federations, the IAAF, said two Kenyans failed doping tests in August at the Beijing World Championship, where Kenya topped the medals table. Wilson Kipsang is the 2014 winner of the London Marathon.
If the Kenyan Federation and the Kenyan government are not strict enough, are not ready enough to intervene in the doping issue, I think if IAAF and will really take an action, if IOC will take an action and maybe ban Kenya, I think it will be so unfortunate to Kenya and to athletes.
Isaac Mwangi, Chief Executive Officer of Athletics Kenya, says the group does not condone doping and anyone found guilty will be punished. Meantime, the IAAF is investigating allegations Kenyan athletics official David Okeyo, who sits on the governing body's decision-making council, and two other officials embezzled hundreds of thousands of dollars in sponsorship money. The Israeli government Sunday approved the entry of 9,000 Ethiopians known as Falashmuro to claim Jewish lineage. Israel brought what was thought at the time to be nearly all of Ethiopia's Jewish community to the Jewish state. That was in the 1980s and 90s under the law of the return. The latest group of Ethiopians has been waiting this decision for years in Ethiopian transit camps. Israel has over 130,000 Jewish Israelis of Ethiopian descent. Problems this community faces, including police brutality, discrimination, and racism, forced thousands to take part in street protests in Tel Aviv earlier this year. Egyptian security officials say police discovered the bodies of 15 African migrants found shot dead in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula near the country's border with Israel and Gaza. Another 8 migrants were also found wounded in the attack. Associated Press identifies them as Sudanese and says they were killed by security forces as they approached the wire fence separating Sinai from Israel. Incident occurred south of the town of Rafah. The desert area has long been the scene of intense fighting between jihadists and security forces since the ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi in 2013. International Organization for Migration says it welcomes a new agreement on a roadmap to manage African migration to Europe. Roadmap was hammered out at a 2-day summit on Malta by the European Union and African countries. Leonard Doyle is a spokesperson for the IOM. He speaks now with VOA's Joe DiCapua about that plan for African migrants.
Well, the important thing is they're talking about addressing the root causes. So by that they mean like tackling everything from war, from poverty, from governance issues, etc. They're recognizing, I think, that migrants are coming because there's an arc of war from Africa all the way to Asia. It's bringing insecurity, causing poverty. And, of course, the impact of climate change is part of the picture, and we're coming up to the Paris Conference on climate change, and that shouldn't be forgotten. So the summit has really said, look, we've got to really start working across the board on migration. We can't simply be just putting up fences in Europe. We've got to help the African countries in particular.
How will this trust fund, this EU trust fund for Africa, work?
Well, if it's managed well and if it's funded properly, it should be able to give funding to African countries to create, you know, a good business environment so that their people feel that they have a chance by staying home to make a decent living for themselves and their communities instead of getting on the bus to go north. The Europeans are recognizing that the Africans need help to grow their economy, to have stable governments, have rule of law, all that kind of thing.
Well, as you know, smuggling is a big business and much of it happens in Libya. Were there any provisions to deal with that?
There was a lot of talk about cracking down on crime, on smuggling, on trafficking. We yet to see any kind of concrete action, but the Europeans are getting their act together there, and they have a whole flotilla operating out of the Mediterranean, and those guys are focusing quite hard on the smuggling piece of it. But frankly, unless you get some nation-building going on in Libya, it's mostly talk. So until the Libyans are helped to get their country together and get some rule of law going, the migrants are going to keep coming.
Now, the IOM says the summit expressed deep concern at the suffering, abuse, and exploitation suffered by women and children and the unacceptable loss of life in the desert or at sea. Is anything in particular being done to help women and children?
Well, I think the fact that it's in the declaration is important. There's a recognition, I think, now that you cannot have business as usual. You have to look after vulnerable people, women, children, people of minorities, people of different beliefs. And I think it's just a recognition that when there is a crisis, it's usually the most vulnerable who suffer most.
Now, it's a roadmap. This is not codified in law. So how will it be implemented and when will it be implemented?
I think when the trust fund gets going and they start getting some projects rolling, it'll be implemented very quickly. But behind the scenes, what the Europeans are most interested in is finding a way to get rid of people who've come in illegally, if you like, without a real chance of getting refugee status. So they're seeking to get returns, as they call them, what we might call deportations. And the Africans are saying, well, we don't want deportations. Do it voluntarily or not at all. Behind the scenes, they're really saying, if you're going to get rid of people and deport them, you better send them back with some financial support, either for them as individuals or for the governments and communities that they're going back to.
Leonard Doyle is a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration. He was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. The coordinated attacks in Paris became a major focus in the U.S. presidential campaign over the weekend. Republican contenders raised the issue in speeches after the attacks, and the Democratic candidates talked of national security and terrorism in a televised debate held in Des Moines, Iowa, and broadcast on CBS. VOA's Catherine Gibson is following the story.
They paused for a moment of silence for the terror victims in Paris. And then the debate opened, with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton distancing herself from President Obama's claim the Islamic State is contained.
We have to look at ISIS as the leading threat of an international terror network. It cannot be contained, it must be defeated. It cannot be an American fight.
All of these nations, they're going to have to get their hands dirty, their boots on the ground. They are going to have to take on ISIS. This is a war for the soul of Islam.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders pointed to Clinton's 2003 war vote.
The disastrous invasion of Iraq, something that I strongly opposed, has unraveled the region completely and led to the rise of Al-Qaeda and to ISIS.
Clinton and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley reaffirmed their commitment to bringing 65,000 refugees to the United States, carefully screened.
I do not want us to inadvertently allow people who wish us harm to come into our country.
Earlier Saturday, following the Paris attacks, Republican presidential candidates attacked those plans.
The president wants to take in 250,000 from Syria.
The craziest thing we could do is to take people who live in a desert, who don't speak our language, who don't understand our culture, and bring them to Minnesota during the winter.
On the debate stage, Clinton came under fire for her ties to Wall Street.
We expect that our president will protect the Main Street economy from excesses on Wall Street.
Clinton defended her links to the financial industry by raising the 2001 World Trade Center attack.
I did spend a whole lot of time and effort helping them rebuild. That was good for New York, it was good for the economy, and it was a way to rebuke the terrorists who had attacked our country.
Iowa State professor Stefan Schmidt, who spoke to VOA via Skype, says Clinton solidified her lead with this debate.
She was strong and decisive. She repelled attacks against her, was humorous, and just at the right moment talked about women's issues and got a lot of applause for that.
The Democrats debate again in mid-December in a race transformed by terror. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now to check out what's trending online about the Democratic presidential debate and how the various candidates are dealing with the Paris attacks online. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. It's been a couple of days, but the manhunt is still ongoing in Paris. And since the attack, many U.S. presidential hopefuls have expressed condolences. Let's begin with the leading Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton. She tweeted this Saturday, "Even after this darkest night, Paris remains the city of light." That's been retweeted almost 7,000 times, and more than 11,000 people liked it. She also sent out this tweet, "Our prayers are with the people of France tonight, but that is not enough." That's a quote from the latest Democratic debate.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is another Democratic contender. What about him?
He tweeted this Friday, "Horrified by the attacks in Paris tonight. My thoughts are with the victims and their loved ones." More than 11,000 people liked that tweet and almost 9,000 shared it. Another tweet reads like this, "Leading the world, this country will rid our planet of the barbaric organization called ISIS." More than 1,000 people shared that tweet and more than 2,600 people liked it.
Let's move on to the Republican Party's contenders for president. I'm sure that Donald Trump had something interesting to say.
Yes, it did. He tweeted this, "When will President Obama issue the words radical Islamic terrorism? He can't say it, and unless he will, the problem will not be solved." That's been retweeted almost 5,000 times and liked by about 10,000 users. Ben Carson, who is following closely behind Trump in polls, sent out a more generic tweet. My thoughts and prayers are with the people in Paris tonight.
What's the trending hashtag on that attack in Paris?
It's hashtag pray for Paris with a number 4 in the middle. In the last 24 hours, that hashtag was used in more than 21,000 tweets. Back to you.
Many thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. You can also follow International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Winter, when days are short, will soon be upon those of us in the Northern Hemisphere. It's the short days that can play havoc with people's moods and well-being. Over 14 million Americans suffer from a form of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. While experts aren't really sure what causes SAD, some think it may be caused by a lack of sunlight in the winter. To treat SAD, some doctors and mental health experts have prescribed light therapy, where patients are exposed to very bright artificial light for 30 minutes or more each day. But a new study has found that cognitive behavioral therapy was much better at preventing SAD patients from relapsing in future winters than light therapy. The study shows that this special form of talk therapy teaches SAD patients to challenge their negative thoughts about dark winter months and resist behaviors like social isolation that can affect a person's mood. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. A new TV series from Amazon, The Man in the High Castle, takes viewers into a world where the Axis powers won World War II and have conquered the United States. International Edition's David Byrd takes a look at the series, a somewhat dystopian view of life under Nazi and Japanese occupation.
The Man in the High Castle is based on Philip K. Dick's 1962 novel of the same name and takes place in 1962. The Allies have lost World War II, and the United States is divided between the Nazis in the East and the Japanese Empire in the West, with a neutral zone between them. Juliana Crane lives in San Francisco, outwardly happy with Japanese rule. But when her half-sister Trudy is killed by the Kempeitai, Japan's equivalent of the SS, Juliana learns that what she thinks she knows might not be true. Before she dies, Trudy hands Juliana a film which contains newsreels of a different outcome, with the Allies winning World War II. Juliana thinks that perhaps the film shows the real world rather than the one in which she lives. Trudy was part of an American resistance and was carrying the film to the neutral zone to meet someone. Juliana decides to take Trudy's place. Rupert Evans stars as Frank Frink, Juliana's boyfriend and a Jew in Nazi-occupied New York.
Frank, I saw Trudy.
What?
I was in the market and I saw her.
You saw the pawns shoot her?
I know it sounds crazy, but I saw her.
Angels, we have to get out of here. The Kempeitai came to the factory today looking for the shooter.
Do you think they were looking for you?
Yeah, told me they didn't ask for anyone by name. I got out before they saw me. Look, the Kempeitai won't let this go until they've got someone.
Okay.
And now, with Arnold, Jules, I have to get out of here. And when they come looking for me, you can't be here either.
French-born American actress Alexa DeValos plays Juliana. She says that while some Americans might balk at the show's premise, it does touch on universal themes.
This takes you away from everything you know. And yet, you know, there's an emotional connection to it. Pain is something that's obviously very timeless, and loss and fear and oppression and fascism and all these things are elements that we have today, unfortunately, and we had when the book was written and prior. So it's relatable, even though it's so incredibly different.
While in Colorado, Juliana meets and falls in love with Joe Blake, a 27-year-old New Yorker who volunteers to help the resistance. But he's really a Nazi double agent looking to infiltrate and betray resistance fighters. Luke Kleintank plays Joe Blake. He says that viewers might have difficulty accepting the show's premise, but will also find it intriguing.
You know, it's chilling. I think they're gonna
I think they're going to have a hard time accepting it. But at the same time, I think they're going to be intrigued by it. I mean, it's a piece of history that could have happened.
Frank Spotnitz is the show's producer, writer, and creator. He says that making the series reminded him of the huge debt the modern world owes to the World War II generation.
And what I've thought a lot about since embarking on this series is the sacrifices that this generation should be making to ensure that we live in a just world and that we live up to the ideals that, you know, our civilization stands for.
The Man in the High Castle also stars Rufus Sewell as John Smith, a ruthless Nazi SS officer. The Man in the High Castle is available to Amazon Prime subscribers beginning November 20th. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
In the wake of the deadly attacks in Paris, the entertainment world is toning down the glitz and scaling back on some of the more anticipated red carpet celebrations. Today's premiere of The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2 in Los Angeles will be a slightly more subdued affair. Out of respect, the film studio said no interviews will be conducted at the premiere, which is the final chapter of the young adult saga. Such gestures proliferated over the weekend as the entertainment industry reacted to the deadly attacks in Paris. Instead of the regular cold opening with a sketch, the TV show Saturday Night Live opened with a tender monologue of solidarity given by cast member Cecily Strong in French as well as in English. Concerts in Paris and tours across Europe were canceled by U2, the Foo Fighters, Coldplay, and others. Madonna went ahead with a concert in Sweden, but said during the show Saturday that she was apprehensive about it. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ambassadors of the United States of America, the Netherlands, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Germany, and Denmark, along with the High Commissioners for the United Kingdom and Canada, in a joint statement issued on November 4th, once again underscored their strong and ongoing support for a vibrant, free, and independent civil society in Kenya. In this context, the statement read, "We welcome the decision by the government of Kenya to suspend the Non-Governmental Organizations Coordination Board's October 29th notice that it intends to cancel the registration certificates of 959 Kenyan NGOs. The original decision announced by the board raised serious concerns and questions about regulation of the sector." The signatories noted that, "As international partners, we are fully committed to supporting appropriate transparency and accountability with regard to NGOs. However, we also believe that regulation must be fair, reasonable, and justly administered. We urge the board to ensure all NGOs have timely information and an adequate opportunity to answer any questions or address concerns. We, as donors, require detailed financial reports and regular audits from NGOs that we partner with, and insist on transparency and accountability in our ongoing oversight. We have no evidence that NGOs to which we provide donor funds are supporting or funding terrorism or are engaged in other illegal activity." The government signatory to the joint statement strongly support the rights to freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association for civil society as is guaranteed in the Constitution of Kenya, and firmly believe that a strong civil society is vital to protecting fundamental rights, strengthening democratic institutions, building prosperity, and ensuring security. NGOs provide a wide range of essential services to Kenyans, including in health care and education. The government's issuing the statement again urged the government of Kenya to implement as soon as possible the Public Benefit Organizations Act of 2013, which provides an excellent framework for the regulation of civil society organizations, while at the same time ensuring transparency and accountability in the sector's work.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.